Welcome. My name is Divine. I am a fourth year medical student. Today's podcast, this will be episode 10, we'll be talking about GI pharmacology. This should basically be a comprehensive GI pharmacology review. Okay, so without wasting so much time, let's go ahead and get in gear. So let's discuss the laxatives, okay? GI pharm is relatively straightforward. So the first laxative we'll discuss is calcium carbonate. Okay, so calcium carbonate obviously causes diarrhea. Okay, but there are just certain high yield things you want to know about this. First thing is calcium. If you go back to your college chemistry, calcium is in group 2 of the periodic table, so it's divalent. And there is this drug that is a bacteriostatic 30S inhibitor that binds divalent ions really well. I hope you're thinking about tetracyclines. So in general, if a person is taking a tetracycline, you want to avoid a divalent containing laxative or GI active agent like calcium carbonate. And because calcium carbonate contains calcium, right, it can cause hypercalcemia. So hypercalcemia is one of the antecedents of the milk alkali syndrome. That's why if you're taking too much calcium carbonate or if you're taking too much vitamin D, you can get milk alkali syndrome. Milk alkali syndrome has two parts of it. There's the part where you're hypercalcemic because you're taking a very heavy calcium load. You can also get a metabolic alkalosis because you're taking a very heavy bicarb load in calcium carbonate. Okay, so something to keep in mind. Now, calcium carbonate is a basic salt, so it has like basic properties. So this is again thinking back to college chemistry. We don't need to go hardcore here, but it's a basic salt. So because it's a basic salt, it has the ability to neutralize acid. So that's why you can use this to treat peptic ulcer disease. Although I'll just tell you right now, essentially everyone gets a PPI for peptic ulcer disease. No one really uses these salts anymore. So you can use it to treat peptic ulcer disease. The only problem is once you stop, the acidity comes right back. So rebound hyperacidity is a very high yield side effect of calcium carbonate. And remember that when an acid reacts with a carbonate, it produces carbon dioxide as a byproduct. So the thing is there a part of your GI tract that has a lot of acid? Well, your stomach. So if you expose your stomach to a lot of calcium carbonate, you make a lot of carbon dioxide and you get all this bloating, you get gas and stuff like that. And just as an aside, remember that you can give a calcium derivative like calcium gluconate as one of the treatments for hyperkalemia, right? So remember, in hyperkalemia, you can get like Peake's T waves, you can get a YQRS. So if you want to protect the myocardium, you can give a calcium carbonate. Now, the next GI active agent I'll talk about is aluminum hydroxide. Think of this drug as being a constipationist, okay? So it causes constipation. And because aluminum is a 3+ ion, it can bind phosphate really well. Remember, phosphate has a 3- ion, so it binds it really well. So this drug can actually cause a hypophosphatemia. And while we're on the topic of hypophosphatemia, we can quickly discuss a refeeding syndrome, right? So if they give you an exam question about a person that has been anorexic for a long time, and then they suddenly eat a lot of food to replenish their stores, the thing is that consumption of food is a very powerful stimulus for insulin release. And insulin, as a general principle, sends a lot of electrolytes into cells. So it can send phosphate into cells and you can get a very severe hypophosphatemia, which can cause a lot of systemic presentations. So that's just something to keep in mind. Another application of insulin driving things into cells is in the treatment of hyperkalemia, right? So insulin increases the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So if a person is hyperkalemic and you give them insulin, but remember to also add on glucose so they don't get hypoglycemic, you give them insulin, you increase the activity of that sodium potassium ATPase pump. Remember that that pump drives pumps three sodiums out and puts two potassiums in. So it puts potassium into the cells. Okay, so that's a kind of redistributive mechanism. Now, the next GI active agent I'll talk about is magnesium hydroxide. Magnesium hydroxide is a laxative. It's not a constipationist like aluminum hydroxide. Okay, but remember, again, this is a divalent ion. Magnesium is element 12 in the periodic table. It's in group 2. So again, you want to avoid this with tetracyclines. And basically, the way magnesium works is it's not easily absorbed in the GI tract, so it just stays in the GI tract And because it's a 2 plus ion, it's super osmotically active. So you get an osmotic diarrhea with magnesium hydroxide. Okay. Now, other laxatives, there's stuff like Docolax and Colace and Senna. These are terms you hear in the hospital, but I'm going to largely skip those. They rarely show up on exams. Now, the constipationist we've talked about, we said aluminum hydroxide causes constipation as a side effect. So you use it if a person has bad diarrhea, right? Other constipationists you can use like mu opioid receptor agonists. So you can use drugs like loperamide, diphenoxylate. These drugs, they both act at mu opioid receptors, so you can use them to treat diarrhea. Okay, you can use them to treat diarrhea. So one thing I'll just go ahead and say here is that if you're taking opioids, let's assume you're abusing opioids, you never develop tolerance to constipation or meiosis. Okay, you never develop tolerance to those things. For other things with opioids, you can get tolerance, but not for meiosis and constipation. Remember, meiosis is papillary constriction. But just as an aside, remember that there's actually one opioid that has mydriasis as a side effect, not meiosis. Okay, this opioid can also cause a serotonin syndrome. It's meperidine. Okay, meperidine is one of those opioids that for some reason they love to give to people with pancreatitis, because the buzzword you hear in hospitals is that it prevents a sphincter of OD spasm. It so happens that meperidine has a serotonergic properties, so you don't want to combine it with another serotonergic agent because you can get a serotonin syndrome. But in addition, meperidine also has muscarinic receptor blocking activity. So because it blocks muscarinic receptors, instead of causing meiosis, it can actually cause a mydriasis. Now, so we're done with the drugs that you could use to treat constipation because they have diarrhea as a side effect, or the drugs used to treat diarrhea because they have constipation as a side effect. So now let's talk about the antiemetics. Okay, the antiemetics. The antiemetics, these are drugs that you give to prevent vomiting. You can get MSS in many contexts on your exam. One context could be in the with a person that's getting chemotherapy for cancer. That's one group. Another group can be a diabetic that has a diabetic gastroparesis. Those people tend to get a lot of vomiting because the food just hanging around in their GI tract sort of activates a few receptors here and there. So let's talk about some of these drugs that could be used to treat vomiting. The first group I'm going to talk about is ondansetron. Okay, ondansetron is a serotonin receptor antagonist. Okay, it's a 5-HT3 receptor antagonist, and the primary use is for chemotherapy associated emesis. Okay, and remember that many chemo drugs cause emesis, but the big one you want to remember for your test are the platinum analogs, especially cisplatin. Okay, especially cisplatin. So ondansetron works that way. Metoclopramide, domperidone, they are also antiemetics. Okay, they block dopamine D2 receptors. Remember, you find these receptors in the chemoreceptor trigger zone in the area postrema. Okay, so by blocking those receptors, you actually make a person not vomit. Okay, and remember that with metoclopramide, domperidone, you want to be careful with the extra pyramidal side effects, because you're essentially giving people an antipsychotic when they take a metoclopramide or domperidone. No one uses domperidone in the US. It's not approved by the FDA in the US. And the thing is, you may be like, Divine, all these receptors are really hard to remember. Let me just tell you this. Basically, if you block any receptor of note that's tested on exams in the chemoreceptor trigger zone, you can treat emesis, right? So we said that, ondansetron is a serotonin receptor, so 5-HT3 receptor antagonist, 5-HT3, right? 5-hydroxytryptophan. Serotonin is derived from tryptophan. Metoclopramide, domperidone, we said they block dopamine D2 receptors. Another receptor you can block is the neurokinin 1 receptor with drugs like aprepitant and fosaprepitant. Okay, so those are drugs that are anti-emetic. So any receptor you block, you can block serotonin with ondansetron, or block dopamine with domperidone and metoclopramide, or you can block neurokinin 1 receptors with aprepitant or fosaprepitant. Okay, now one last thing is steroids. Remember that steroids, they do actually increase your secretion of acid. So one of the effects, in addition to the like the Cushingoid facies and all that fun stuff you get with steroids, steroids actually increase acidity. So peptic ulcer disease is actually a classic side effect of prolonged steroid use. In fact, if they describe a person that has been on long-term steroids and they have epigastric pain, think about a peptic ulcer disease. So if a person needs to be on steroids chronically, let's assume they have like rheumatoid arthritis or some kind of autoimmune disease, and you want to place them on chronic steroids, you actually need to prophylax them with two high-yield medications. The first high-yield medication you want to prophylax with is a PPI to reduce the secretion of acid. And you also want to prophylax those people with a bisphosphonate, okay? So that, because remember, steroids are associated with osteoporosis. Okay, so let's talk about the drugs that suppress acids. I sort of use that steroid story to introduce this concept. But before we can do that, I think we should spend some time doing some quick physiology to understand the mechanisms behind acid secretion. So one thing that can increase acid secretion is acetylcholine. Okay, so acetylcholine can very easily act on muscarinic M3 receptors. Remember, that's GQ coupled. So you can act on muscarinic M3 receptors on the surfaces of parietal cells, and that makes you make more acid. Alternatively, your parasympathetic nervous system can also make something known as gastrin-releasing peptide. If I just said that it releases gastrin-releasing peptide, what do you think GRP does? It makes your G cells release gastrin. Okay, that's kind of obvious. So, makes your G cells, they release more gastrin. And just as a quick aside, remember, if you have a gastrinoma, that has an association with the Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, okay, which can be a component of MEN1, okay, MEN1. Now, gastrin does many things. Gastrin, it comes from G cells, like I said. It can directly activate parietal cells through the CCKB receptor, okay, the cholecystokinin B receptor. That makes you make more acid. Alternatively, gastrin can also activate enterochromaffin-like cells, okay, ECL cells, to produce more histamine, okay? And that histamine can act on H2 receptors on the surfaces of parietal cells, which are GS-coupled, okay, to increase the activity of adenylate cyclase and release more acid, okay? So basically, one construct you sort of want to get in your brain is that an increase in cyclic AMP or increased activity of adenylate cyclase causes more acid secretion. Okay, and just as a weird hematology tie-in here, one thing I want you to think about is many people that have the myeloproliferative disorders, right? So those people tend to get an increase in all their blood cell lines, right? So their red cells increase in number, their platelets increase in number, their white cells increase in number. One high yield cell that increases in number is the basophils. Those basophils can actually secrete histamine, right? So if a basophil degranulates, it can release histamine into the circulation. That histamine can go and act on H2 receptors on the surfaces of parietal cells and cause peptic ulcer disease. So if they give you a question about epigastric pain in a person with a history of some kind of myeloproliferative disorder like polycythemia vera or CML or essential thrombocythemia, I really want you to think about basophils secreting histamine and causing a hyperacidity. So again, histamine, we said it increases acid secretion. It comes from ECL cells, enterochromaffin-like cells, okay? Those cells in the stomach secrete histamine. That histamine activates parietal cells through H2 receptors, okay? And you make more acid that way. Prostaglandins, on the other hand, they actually cause a decrease in acid secretion, okay? So the prostaglandin receptors you find on the surfaces of parietal cells, they're actually GI-coupled, okay? So they decrease the activity of adenylate cyclase, they decrease the production of cyclic AMP, and in so doing, you decrease the release of acid, okay? So as a quick tie-in here, if a person is taking aspirin, okay, for chronic osteoarthritis. Remember, aspirin is an irreversible COX-1 and 2 inhibitor. So when you inhibit that, you make less prostaglandins. So if you went ahead and gave a person a prostaglandin analog like misoprostol, a PGE1 analog, you can sort of prophylax against aspirin-induced peptic ulcer disease. And somatostatin also decreases acid secretion. It basically decreases secretion of anything notable in the body. okay? And parietal cells, right, they're the cell of the hour. They're the big cells that secrete acid, and they use a hydrogen potassium antipodder. So they pump hydrogen into the lumen of the stomach and bring potassium into the cell. And that should make sense, right, because you're trying to maintain electron neutrality. If you release a positive charge from a cell, you want to you also want to bring a positive charge into the cell to sort of balance charges, okay? And remember that these protons that are secreted from the cell, they don't just come out from thin air, okay? They actually come from carbonic anhydrase. Carbonic anhydrase splits carbonic acid into H plus and bicarb in the parietal cell. So the H plus goes towards the lumen, the bicarb goes out the basal side of the cell, and because bicarb has a negative charge, right, you want to again maintain electron neutrality. So one way you do that is you bring in chloride, okay? So you're dumping bicarb into the bloodstream, you're bringing chloride into the cell, so you actually get hypochloremic as you're digesting food, because remember, in the process of food digestion, you're making more acid, and you also get a metabolic alkalosis with that, because you're dumping bicarb into the serum. So you get a hypochloremic metabolic alkalosis with food digestion, although it's a transient effect. Okay, so the blood pH increases when you're digesting food, okay? Something to keep in mind. And just real quick, again, remember that if you make autoantibodies against parietal cells, that's a pernicious anemia, right? So those people will get a megaloblastic anemia because they're not making intrinsic factor. And intrinsic factor is like the body for B12 to be reabsorbed in the terminal ileum. So now that we've talked about all this physiology, it's much easier to know what the drugs do, okay? So the first drug class we'll talk about are the histamine H2 receptor blockers, okay? These drugs all end in tidine. So drugs like ranitidine, nizatidine, cimetidine, they work by blocking histamine H2 receptors, okay? So the receptors that these drugs work on should be found on the surfaces of parietal cells, okay? Step one and board exams, they occasionally love to just see if you really know where these receptors are, okay? The histamine H2 receptors are found on the surfaces of parietal cells, okay? So these drugs, they suppress acid secretion. The big thing you want to know about them, in addition to their role as histamine H2 receptor blockers, is you want to remember cimetidine, okay? Cimetidine is actually an androgen receptor antagonist, so it can actually cause a gynecomastia as a side effect because it's that estrogen testosterone ratio is tilting you more towards a hyper estrogenic state if you think in terms of ratios. And it's also an inhibitor of cytochrome P450, so just another thing to keep in mind with cimetidine. Okay, so they can easily test that in the context of a person getting drug toxicity, a drug that's metabolized by your CP450 system. You can get more side effects because you boost drug levels with cimetidine. Now, the next drugs that block acid secretion are the PPIs, okay, the proton pump inhibitors. They all end in prazole. So these are drugs like esomeprazole, pantoprazole, lansoprazole, omeprazole. You get the drift. These drugs basically work by irreversibly inhibiting the hydrogen potassium antipodder on the surface of parietal cells, okay? So they are the most powerful acid suppressants, okay? So by blocking that antipodder, you do not secrete hydrogen ions into the lumen of the stomach, okay? So these drugs, they have many side effects, okay? And in fact, let's talk about them one by one. One side effect they have is that they can cause a vitamin B12 deficiency. So what's the mechanism behind that? The mechanism behind that is that, let's think of this for a second, right? So we know that there are certain cells in the GI tract known as chief cells, okay? Chief cells, they make pepsinogen. That pepsinogen, it's a zymogen form of the enzyme. It needs to be converted to the active form pepsin, okay? To go from pepsinogen to pepsin, you need acid to make that happen, the acidity of the stomach, okay? And then that pepsin can help you cleave vitamin B12 from animal protein. Remember, vitamin B12 is derived primarily from meat, from animal protein, okay? So if you're taking a PPI, right, you suppress acid secretion, you have less conversion of pepsinogen to pepsin, so you cleave less vitamin B12 from animal protein, so that B12 just stays sequestered in animal protein, and you don't have a chance to reabsorb it, okay? So that is how you can get vitamin B12 deficiency with the intake of proton pump inhibitors. So they can cause a B12 deficiency, and they actually increase your risk of certain infections, right? So like they increase your risk of C. diff colitis because, again, the acidity of your stomach is quite good at killing off C. diff. Alternatively, they also increase your risk of aspiration pneumonia. Again, that acidity of your stomach has an antibacterial function. So if that antibacterial function is gone, okay, and you imagine, let's assume you're an alcoholic, you drink too much booze because you're celebrating that you matched into residency or that you crushed step one, so you pass out on the ground or something, and then you vomit and then you aspirate your secretions. And let's assume you're taking a PPI for some bizarre reason because you have a stress ulcer from being stressed from studying for step one, okay? That perfect storm can increase a person's risk of aspiration pneumonia, okay? So just things to keep in mind with PPIs. Another thing is these PPIs, they do have some ability to block potassium channels, okay? And I mean, like, this is more teleological explanation, but think about it. If something has the ability to block a hydrogen potassium pump, it should make sense that it could potentially like do something to potassium channels, okay? So it blocks, they have some potassium channel blocking activity. And as we'll discuss when we get to the antiarrhythmics, you can already begin to imagine that this can cause, by blocking potassium channels, you can prolong the QT interval and you can get a torsade de pointe. Okay, so that's something you want to keep in mind with PPIs. Don't just prescribe PPIs like candy to your patients in the future. And just as a real quick review, remember that there are many other causes of a prolonged QT interval, right? So any notable electrolyte anomaly that has hypo in the name can all cause a QT prolongation, right? So like hypokalemia, hypocalcemia, hypomagnesemia, those all cause QT prolongation that can cause torsade de pointe and you can die, okay? And remember, the way you treat the torsade is with magnesium, okay? Remember, torsade de pointe is a polymorphic ventricular tachycardia. And a mild side effect as well, this is quite low yield, but it's something that is definitely testable, is that PPIs, they can actually increase your risk of osteoporosis. Okay, now, real quick though, before we dump these PPIs, in the context of H. pylori, your PPIs can actually be a constituent of triple therapy, okay, for H. pylori, okay? So remember, the triple therapy is clarithromycin, okay, that's a macrolide, that's a 50S inhibitor. Amoxicillin, okay, remember that's a penicillin, so it inhibits transpeptidase. And then a PPI, okay, so you can remember CAP, for the, that's a nice mnemonic for that. So PPIs, you can actually use them for H. pylori. And one unusual step, one question you could get is a person that you suspect they have H. pylori and they're about to come into the hospital for testing, or I guess the physician's office for testing. And they ask, oh, which of the following drugs should be stopped or whatever. Okay, you want to go ahead and stop the PPI. Because again, remember, PPIs have activity against H. pylori. Okay. And then also don't forget that PPIs can also be used in quadruple therapy, okay, for H. pylori, right? So remember, quadruple therapy, you have a metronidazole, you have bismuth subsalicylate, we'll talk about that in a bit. You have tetracyclines. Again, remember, those are your bacteriostatic 30S inhibitors, and then you have your PPIs as well. And don't forget that H. pylori is Silverstein positive and it's a urease positive bug, okay? Being urease positive is what makes it wreak havoc on your stomach, because by having expressing a lot of urease, you can basically neutralize a ton of the acid that's secreted by your parietal cells. Now, just a grab bag of other drugs and conditions that relate to GI pharmacology. So don't forget orlistat, okay? So remember, to break down triglycerides, you need lipase. If you don't have lipase activity, you don't break down triglycerides, and you basically just poop them out. So that's how a drug like orlistat works. Orlistat is a lipase inhibitor. So by inhibiting lipase, you don't break down triglycerides, you just basically poop them out, okay? Now, gastroparesis, basically, it's something that they will classically test on exams in the context of a diabetic. And if a diabetic has gastroparesis, right, so things are not moving through their GI tract, you want to try to give them things that can make their GI tract move, Okay, so the thing is your parasympathetic system, right? So think of yourself as resting and digesting. Imagine yourself like just sitting on a restroom and reading a newspaper, not worrying about the worries of a med student like step one or step two CK. So you sit down, you're resting, digesting, you're pooping, right? That's a relaxed state. That's a parasympathetic state. So I'm just using that to help you remember that. I'm using that to remind you that your parasympathetic system makes things move through your GI tract. So, if a person had a gastroparetic disorder, one way you can treat that is to give something that activates a parasympathetic effect. So, one thing you could do with that is you could give a direct muscarinic receptor agonist. Okay, so drugs that fall under this purview include drugs, things like bethanycol. Bethanycol is a muscarinic agonist. So you can use that to treat gastroparesis, but you can also use bethanycol to treat post-surgical ileus, okay? Because again, by activating muscarinic receptors, you increase flux through the GI tract. Another thing you can do to boost the parasympathetic effect is to inhibit acetylcholinesterase, right? So remember that acetylcholinesterase breaks down acetylcholine. So if you inhibited acetylcholinesterase, your acetylcholine levels build up, okay? And you can increase flow through your GI tract. So that's how a drug like neostigmine works, okay? Neostigmine, you can also use that, like I mentioned for bethanycol, to treat post-op ileus. Now, if you remember for your studies of micropharmacology, and we'll have a series of podcasts on that in the future, but you've probably learned that macrolides have GI upset as a side effect, right? So remember, your macrolides are your 50S inhibitors that inhibit translocation, and they are bacteriostatic in general. And use them to treat atypical causes of pneumonia like mycoplasma, chlamydia, and legionella, right? So your macrolides, they have GI upset as a side effect, and you may have wondered, what's the mechanism behind that? The thing is, there is a receptor in the GI tract known as motilin, okay? Motilin receptor. Motilin receptors respond to motilin, okay? And motilin is endogenously secreted in the GI tract, makes our GI tract sort of move along, okay? But the thing is, you could give an exogenous motilin receptor agonist, like erythromycin, and by activating those receptors, you make your GI tract motile, okay? So by increasing flux through your GI tract, you can use a motilin receptor agonist like erythromycin to treat ileus and also diabetic gastroparesis. And the next drug I'll talk about that you can use for gastroparesis works with a certain construct. And this construct, I just want to introduce it now. I'll develop this construct further when we talk about psychiatric pharmacology. But basically, this construct is that low levels of dopamine, so just remember it for now. We'll talk about this some more later. But low levels of dopamine equals high levels of acetylcholine. Low levels of dopamine equals high levels of acetylcholine. Okay? So if you memorize this construct, the thing you want to remember is that if you blocked dopamine receptors, your levels of acetylcholine will go up. Okay? So metoclopramide is a drug that could also be used for diabetic gastroparesis. Because by blocking dopamine receptors, it increases your levels of acetylcholine, and that increases flux through your GI tract. So metoclopramide is a prokinetic agent, okay? Now, last series of conditions I'll mention in the context of GI pharm. First will be a hepatic encephalopathy, okay? So remember, if a person has liver disease, they have an ammonia problem because the urea cycle is not working. So one way you could sort of deal with this ammonia problem is to try to trap it in the GI tract, okay? You can try to poop out the ammonia. So how can you do this? The thing is, ammonia is reabsorbed in the GI tract, but ammonium is not, okay? Because it's an ionic compound, so it's not reabsorbable. So lactic acid can, remember it's an acid, right? So it can protonate ammonia, make it into ammonium. You don't reabsorb it and you poop it out. So how can you make lactic acid? You can make lactic acid from a compound known as lactulose. Okay, lactulose, your GI flora, convert it to lactic acid. That lactic acid goes ahead and protonates ammonia, makes ammonium. It's an ionic non-resorbable compound, so you poop it out in the from the GI tract. Okay, Second way you can also deal with the ammonia problem is you could say, you know what, let me try to decrease the potential sources of ammonia. Because the thing is, it's not just our diet containing protein that gives us an ammonia load. You can actually also get an ammonia load from the bugs in your GI tract. Your GI flora do make ammonia. So one thing you can do is just to kill all of them. Okay, so one way you can kill off all your GI flora is with a drug known as a rifaximin. Okay, rifaximin, it really sounds a lot like rifampin. Okay, they actually have a very similar mechanism of action. Rifaximin is an RNA polymerase inhibitor. Okay, so it kills off your GI flora, you kill off a source of ammonia production, and you could potentially relieve the symptoms a person gets in the context of hepatic encephalopathy. And just remember real quick that TIPS procedures, right? So this is classically done by IR. TIPS procedure is, I think that stands for transjugular intrahepatic podosystemic shunt. Okay, so basically it's just a conduit you create between your hepatic and portal veins to acutely decrease the portal pressures. If you think about it, if you make that conduit, you're basically bypassing your liver, you're bypassing the metabolic effects of the liver. So TIPS procedures actually increase your risk of hyperammonemia and hepatic encephalopathy. But again, you want to use a TIPS procedure if a person has high portal pressures and they have like really bad side effects from that, like esophageal varices. Okay. Now, another grab bag GI condition is a cholestatic autoimmune problem. So if you get an exam question about a lady in her 40s that has a lot of pruritus, okay, and she has a direct hyperbilirubinemia, what are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about primary biliary cholangitis. This was previously known as primary biliary cirrhosis. Okay. Remember the association with anti-mitochondrial antibodies. The pathophysiology is you're basically making autoantibodies against intrahepatic bile ducts. Please don't confuse this with primary sclerosing cholangitis, which has an ulcerative colitis association, PNCA, okay, where you actually make autoantibodies against the intra and extrahepatic bile ducts. Okay, so in PBC, you make autoantibodies just against the intrahepatic bile ducts. In PSC, you make autoantibodies against the intrahepatic and extrahepatic bile ducts. But again, because you're making autoantibodies against bile ducts, you have no problems conjugating bilirubin, but you can get it out of the liver. Okay, so you get a conjugated hyperbilirubinemia. So in general, one way you can treat these conditions is with a drug known as orsodiol, also known as ursodeoxycholic acid. So you give this drug and it actually does improve survival in patients with PBC. It generally does not improve survival in PSC, but in PBC there have been studies that show that orsodiol does in fact improve survival. And then if a person has ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, again, another grab bag GI condition, you can give steroids, you can give TNF inhibitors. We'll talk about TNF inhibitors later. You can also give a drug known as sulfasalazine, okay? They occasionally call it 5-ASA or 5-aminosalicylic acid, okay? It's an anti-inflammatory agent, okay? Because again, it basically contains aspirin. If you may remember, aspirin actually does have anti-inflammatory properties. So by giving an anti-inflammatory agent, you can sort of tune down the inflammation you get in UC and Crohn's. But generally on exams, sulfasalazine is used primarily to treat ulcerative colitis. Another grab bag set of GI drugs are propranolol, spironolactone. You can actually use them for chronic prophylaxis in a person that has chronic portal hypertension and esophageal varices, because the thing they do is that they cause splanchnic vasoconstriction, so they decrease pressures in the portal system by some unknown mechanism, and you could use those as chronic prophylaxis against an esophageal bleed. Although you do not want to give these, in general, you don't give these drugs acutely. The drug you give acutely for esophageal varices is octreotide, okay? But chronic prophylaxis, you can give propranolol and spironolactone. And then for ulcers in the GI tract, right? So those ulcers, one thing you potentially want to do to ulcers is you want to sort of like coat them so that they heal, okay? Because if you keep exposing ulcers to the acidity of the GI tract, they don't heal in the first place. So one way you can promote ulcer healing, if you may, is to give a cytoprotective agent. That's the buzzword you want to recognize on exams, okay? A cytoprotective agent. You want to give drugs like bismuth, okay? Bismuth subsalicylate is a cytoprotective agent. But in addition to actually being a cytoprotective agent by coating ulcers, it also causes constipation as a side effect. So you can actually give it to a person that has diarrhea, right? So if you've ever heard of the drug Imodium, Imodium contains bismuth subsalicylate. So you're basically using the constipation side effect to lock up your GI tract. Bismuth, remember that it also makes your stool black. It so happens that some of the bugs in your GI tract make hydrogen sulfide, and bismuth can react with that hydrogen sulfide to make your stool tarry black. The other cytoprotective agent is sucralfate. Okay, sucralfate is an aluminum containing compound, sucralfate, right? So all has aluminum. It's positively charged, okay? Most ulcers are negatively charged. So you have those ionic interactions, and again, you basically protect ulcers, okay? You give them a chance to heal. So that is all I am going to say about GI pharmacology. If you have any questions, please let me know, and I hope to see you guys in the next podcast, okay? I wish you all the best and enjoy a wonderful weekend. Have a bye.